Welcome to the CenturyLink Cloud Podcast, where we give technology, ingenuity, collaboration, and thought leadership a voice. To learn more about the CenturyLink Cloud platform, please visit www.ctl.io. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy day to give us a listen.
All right, welcome to the CLC podcast. I am Jonathan Townsend on the content team based in St. Louis. With me today, I'm very lucky and honored to talk to Ryan Kirk, who is based in Bellevue. And Ryan is a principal data scientist at CenturyLink Cloud. And how are you doing today, Ryan?
I'm doing well, and thank you.
So, Ryan, I'd like for you to let listeners know a little bit about yourself, your background in your job, and maybe how long you've been with CenturyLink and what you're currently working on.
Yeah, sounds good. So, I've been in the data science industry for a while. I used to be called an applied research scientist, and now the buzzword is data scientist, so I'll stick with that. But the gist of what we try to accomplish is to unify some business expertise and some research methodologies and some technical expertise in terms of algorithms and statistics, and bring that together to help solve business problems. And, you know, for me personally, I'm interested in helping contribute to decision making. So my research areas relate to helping people build adaptive systems that incorporate some of the data from the business into systems that either create recommendations or even sometimes, you know, if we can, create automatic actions. And so I want to just contribute to that feedback loop where we take data, help create recommendations, and then sort of improve the ability to recommend things over time.
So while we were talking before this podcast, we were talking about the sporting industry and how analytics, data cultivation, data analysis is almost akin to a language that's being developed and being translated for target audiences that can leverage it. Can you kind of relate that to what happens at CenturyLink Cloud and kind of carry that analogy forward to what you're currently working on?
Sure. Yeah, in the sports analytics industry, you know, they're trying to figure out how they can get the right players and create the right strategies to be successful when they compete against other teams. And that's kind of similar to business. You know, we have our team, which is our set of products, and we're in our marketplace, which has other teams as well. Other companies are in that marketplace. What we're trying to do is figure out how to optimize our product, which is really our strategy, you know, our players are our product. And we look at what the outputs of that product are. If it's, you know, if it's going to be data related to the devices, if it's going to be data related to people's interactions with the product, you know, those are things, those are similar to things like the performance of a player in a sporting event. And we can look at the performance of our products and we can try to figure out how to improve it through changing the product or changing the strategy or through changing the process that we use when we integrate the product.
So much of what I've learned just from talking to you and working with you on some articles is there's this need to understand how to use the data in a certain way to achieve whatever the end goal is. Can you kind of walk me through how you cull the information and data from a finding for a specific target audience? So, for instance, if you're working with a product or a service, how do you make decisions on what to cut out and what to present to another set of people?
Sure. So the trick is to start basically from the ground and build up from there. And you build this stuff in layers. It doesn't happen immediately. It's like a lot of things where you kind of start with, like if you're going to go bake some cookies, you need to kind of figure out first how to make them. You maybe look at some recipes or what other people have done in the past. Then you have to collect the ingredients. And then it's a matter of assembling those ingredients and applying the right process to create the outcome that you're looking for. So for us, you know, the ingredients are really the data that we get from our products. And we don't want to use all of our ingredients. We only want to use the ones that we know are going to create the final outcome that's going to be impactful for the decision-making process. So we start by sort of figuring out the problem space. We want to define the problem space through talking to domain experts and business experts and narrow down the kinds of things we consider to a smaller and smaller set, to the point where we have pretty good confidence that the things we're considering actually will relate to the problem at hand. And then we can test the relationship between those variables and the outcome variable and see if those things we think are important actually are. And once we find that they're important, we can share those variables directly with the business. And people do that right now. In business intelligence software, we show the key KPIs or the key performance indicators that relate to certain business objectives. You know, in baseball, a KPI is like runs batted in, you know, like your RBI or like your number of times at bat. And those are the kinds of things that you want to keep track of and share with the manager of the team so you can understand the performance of the players. And in business, we have KPIs that we use to understand the performance of our products and to understand the performance of our devices. And we use those KPIs to then start to create predictions. Once you have a set of KPIs that you believe relate strongly to your outcomes, you can start to build models that take advantage of those KPIs. And you move a little bit beyond just business intelligence and you move into predictive intelligence. And predictive intelligence is really the understanding of the historic relationships between variables and using that to create a future understanding of those variables. And you can test the performance of a prediction by applying it to future data and then see if see how well that actually predicts the thing you're trying to figure out. And so we typically validate these systems by applying them in the wild and on some set of the data and see how well they do. And then that allows us to continue to improve them and to refine them. At CenturyLink Cloud, we have a lot of different problems we're working on. And it's like any business, we want to continue to try to improve and optimize our products. And a lot of the places where we focus our analysis is on internal the problems that we try to focus our analysis on relate to internal products such as the cloud platform itself. And we want to have a high level and real-time understanding of the performance of the cloud. We want to make sure that it's working correctly. We want to be alerted immediately if there's something anomalous taking place. We want to make sure that we have enough capacity in the cloud that we can continue to use it and that customers can continue to organically grow in the future. And so there's a lot of different use cases we want to try to predict, because when we do the prediction successfully, it helps us optimize our product, right? Which is really our players, so that our team can be successful.
So one of the first projects that I worked with you on is a blog post, is two series, is the capacity planning, which dovetails really nicely into this conversation with regards to the predictive abilities of your team and what you do. Can you tell us why something like consumer behavior actually matters and how you use that to carry out capacity planning as a project or as a process?
Sure. Yeah, so consumer behavior matters primarily because the future use of our product will be defined by the behaviors of our users. And the way we can understand our product now is through the behavior of our users. And so a perfectly valid approach would be to understand the future state of our product in terms of the current state of our product and the interactions of our users. And so to apply that more directly, if we want to figure out how likely a player is to score a run on any given play in baseball, what we can do is actually keep track of what their performance was historically. Okay, and that gives us a pretty good indication of what it's going to be in the future. It doesn't guarantee that they're going to have as much success in the future as they did in the past, but directionally it'll be pretty accurate. And maybe you'll be a little high on some players and a little low on others. But when you try to then predict the performance for the overall team, you'll be fairly accurate because, you know, the players that you're a little high on and the players you're a little low on will sort of average out, and your prediction will be more or less accurate in terms of the number of runs you can expect for the number of at-bats that you have. So, that, and I think that there's a lot of similarity there in terms of how we predict with our products using consumer behavior. We can look at what our customers have been doing in the past at a high level. We're not, I mean, keep in mind that we're just sort of observing what happens to the platform. We're not really gathering any sort of personal details. We're just looking at, you know, what's the total utilization of a certain host or something like that that has, you know, many such VMs on it. And we can look at, you know, the utilization of that host as it relates to different times of day and things like that. And we can roll that up across different locations and create, you know, if each data center is kind of like a baseball team, we can sort of figure out what the performance of the data center will be in the future based upon the behaviors in the past through figuring out what each of the hosts are up to, and then, you know, sort of projecting that into the future. And we'll be a little high on some hosts and a little low on others, but overall the forecast is pretty accurate considered at the data center level. And so the reason this is successful is because, you know, our platform really is defined, the use of our platform really is defined by the people that, the use of our platform really is defined by the behaviors of the people using it. So, you know, if we want to figure out how much capacity we need, it's really a function of how many people are on the platform and how much the combined usage of those people.
So another part of your job or the practice that you're involved in is forecasting. And you have to forecast differently for different types of devices. Can you walk us through how that works and how this allows you to use approach that's both linear and nonlinear when it comes to creating these forecasts for people?
Yeah, sure. So we have a, the idea is that you have certain kinds of devices such as computers that have hosts, and the hosts really dictate the amount of CPU and of memory that you have available. Then you have other kinds of devices that really relate to like storage, for example, or devices that relate to the network traffic. And each of these devices has a different kind of total capacity, whether it's network bandwidth or storage capacity or memory capacity, or if it's the number of gigahertz that your CPU has. Either any of these would actually. I was talking about different kinds of devices. So we have devices like storage devices and compute devices and network devices, and they each have different kinds of capacity. But what seems to be what is typically true is that we can start at the device level and take into account the typical usage of that device, and then we can roll that up to the next level and figure out the typical usage of maybe that host or maybe that data store. Then we can take that to the next level and figure out the typical use of that virtual cluster, or maybe even that data center itself. And so we can iteratively roll up across these devices. And when I say linear, what I mean is we use an algorithm to forecast what we think the future growth in that device will be using what the previous growth was. And the optimal solution to that is a linear regression. We've sort of proven that in the field. And so, especially if it's a linear model, that's the least error way to forecast a linear model. So we can use that. We can also use a nonlinear model depending on if it's a better fit. The way that we perform capacity planning actually is sort of a hybrid approach whereby we will use a linear model, but then the confidence boundaries, the boundaries around our prediction, we will allow those to be nonlinear as a function of the historic basically fluctuations in the data. So the reason we do that is because certain larger customers use much more resources than smaller customers. And so our future confidence is kind of a function of the typical growth of our smaller customers, but also the number of expected larger customers that will come onto the platform. And so it's kind of this to model the fact that certain larger events occur infrequently and then impact the growth, we can model that as sort of a nonlinear confidence boundary. And so we do that all up across devices, and that gives us a forecast for typically I create forecasts at the cluster level or the rack level, because you know that's what integrates the best with our procurement strategy, where we actually deploy entire pods of storage and of compute resources all at once. You know, it's not like a typical consumer where you buy a computer and it has your memory, your storage, and a network card and stuff like that. We buy an entire, you know, rack of storage at once, or usually many such racks of storage, sometimes entire data centers. But when we buy it, it has all these different kinds of resources. And we have to figure out which resource, different kinds of resources. We have compute resources, we have storage resources, and network resources. The capacity planning work that I've been involved in primarily relates to compute and storage resources, but we do also help predict capacity for network. The way we do network is a little bit different, so I'm going to primarily focus on the compute and storage resources, because those are really a function of the aggregate behavior of our consumers. And so for each device, what we can do is look at how much was that device used in the past. And actually here, it's useful to explain what I mean by device, because these devices are different than like your laptop, which has integrated memory, integrated compute and storage, and a network card. You know, these devices are much larger. They're racks of storage and actually collections of racks that have been virtualized through the use of a hypervisor. And so our unit of analysis, meaning the thing that we're actually examining, is typically a virtual abstraction on top of many pieces of hardware. And the reason it's important to think about the unit of analysis is because the hypervisor, for example, will perform automated load balancing across all of the things that it has available to it. And this is especially true on the compute and memory side of things, where you know it's almost instantaneous for a hypervisor to change the allocation of a load on terms of CPU. Change the allocation of storage is much more time intensive and needs to happen a little bit ahead of time. But fortunately, the growth of storage in terms of its utilization is also slower than the growth of compute. You know, you can run out of memory and CPU almost immediately, whereas you know storage, it takes time to write to disk, so you have a longer time to lead up to a run on those resources. And so what we find is our ability to load balance is sort of related to the rate at which those resources can get utilized. And so we want to make sure that our capacities that we have allow us to predict what we think the future expected level of usage will be, but also what we think the maximum future level of usage will be. And that maximum level of future usage is important because usually it's a little bit nonlinear, meaning that, you know, whereas a straight line would tell you that, you know, in the future you're going to have maybe 30% more, you're need 30% more capacity. You know, a nonlinear line could tell you that, you know, you might need something like 40 to 50%, depending upon the number of large events that you have. So you have to think about the likelihood of large customers coming onto the platform, because if a large customer comes onto the platform, they might be a tangible size. They might be like a tangible amount of the total usage of that virtual machine, of that virtual cluster. So if someone comes on that's, you know, maybe makes up like 10% of the total size of that virtual cluster, then it's hard to load balance that, because you can't really go between clusters, at least not yet. And so and when they come on the platform and they grow organically at, let's say they grow at the same rate as everyone else, but now you've had that 10% boost, and maybe you have another person that comes and has a 10% of the total platform. So the idea that larger customers will join the platform, these are not organic events. These are like new customer signup events. And so we also want to account for the typical number of larger events that we will see. And so to that extent, our future growth is both linear and nonlinear. It's linear in that, you know, the optimal we can still, and it's still true that the optimal way to predict for a straight line is using linear regression, the least error way. But in terms of accounting for these rarer events, we can model that through creating a sort of a nonlinear confidence boundary around that sort of says, you know, we might have one of these things happening every so often, and you know, in the future, how many of these things do you think we will have had happen? So we kind of combine both this idea of organic and sort of inorganic growth into a single model. And I don't want to send the message that new large customers are inorganic. It's just that, you know, they're not as common as someone who's spinning up one or two machines.
All right, so when we talk about growth, it seems like there's two types. There's this process-oriented and behavior-oriented growth. How do you handle and how do you leverage these linear and nonlinear patterns to things that are more uncertain and in more of the category of anomalies in what you do?
That's a good point. So when it comes to capacity planning, we don't worry about as anomalies as often as when we are worried about like incident management and prevention of attacks and things like that. And so it's definitely the case that we still have anomalous usage of the platform in the sense that someone comes in and wants a machine that's as large as like an entire cluster, for example. I mean, that would definitely be an anomaly from our perspective because it's an event that's hard to plan for because it's much, much larger than the typical things that you see. And so in cases like that, and what I mean by process-oriented planning is we can't simply use a forecasting and prediction algorithm to create our capacity planning. We also have to incorporate the knowledge that we have as a business of the process changes that we're going to make. So let's say the business wants to put all of the, for example, all of the guest accounts, the new trial accounts on the same data center. Well, if that happens, then that data center will grow much faster than we had anticipated, right? And that's a process change that's hard to predict because it's not a function of the previous behavior that was taking place in that data center. And so for a process change like that, you have to kind of append your predictions with the knowledge of what those processes could do to the platform. The same is true for larger customers. If you've got a really large machine that you want to add to the platform, you're going to have to really incorporate that into your plan by basically just adding a certain amount of additional capacity related to the size of your sales channel or related to the number of new contracts you expect to have in the near future.
So when we talk about forecasting, and I'll try to go into the next phase of our discussion, but how do you factor in or how do forecasts factor into a stakeholder's risk tolerance? And can you maybe describe what risk tolerance actually is with regards to what you do?
That's a good question. It's a complicated question, Jonathan. I mean, the reality is that risk is different than uncertainty. And we can manage risk, but we cannot manage uncertainty. And so if there's things that we're uncertain of in terms of like process changes and things like that, we'll have to more or less come up with a list of things we're uncertain of and try to drive clarity there as a part of a business conversation, as a part of performing. So this is where a data scientist can act like a qualitative researcher and go out and interview people and see what's actually going to take place in the future and try to get a sense for the kinds of things that we need to incorporate into the model. And in terms of, let's say that we've incorporated all the things that we think are going to happen in the future. That doesn't mean there's no uncertainty. It just means that we've done our best and now we're going to try to predict what's going to happen. There's still going to be risk involved. And the risk is a function of the known variability in your system. And you can manage risk by you creating technologies that help load balance. You can manage risk by creating predictions that have confidence boundaries. And you can manage risk by having a faster iteration cycle in the business. And all three of these things, if done in tandem, give you a great ability to handle risk. And I guess I'll talk about the one that relates to my work the most, which is the idea of incorporating the the confidence boundary into a prediction. And that's really the risk there is that, you know, there's going to be data points that are outside your range of expectation. And we can understand the size of the variability in our data by looking at what's happened in the past. And we can use that to say we want to have, you know, like a 90% confidence that this forecast will cover the expected future states of the cloud, for example. And the business can tell you what they think the confidence level should be. And in exchange for increasing confidence, we can explain to them that that will increase the expected amount of resources necessary to have that level of confidence. Because the higher confidence, the higher the confidence level required is, the more resources you'll have to have available, because the confidence boundary basically accounts for the outliers in the data. And the more the outliers you want to account for, the higher your threshold has to be. And so we incorporate that into the model typically as a tunable parameter that the business can use to optimize their decisions. So we'll actually, in this linear forecasting example, we'll incorporate that directly as a parameter in our model. And if the business wants more confidence, we can turn it up. And if they want less, we can turn it down. And to an extent, then you explain to them that, you know, there's a whatever percent chance that we won't be able to cover the future state. And that's a risk that we can manage in other ways. For example, let's say we have 80% confidence. So that leaves us a 1 in 5 chance that we'll be out of our expected range. But the reality is that if we have a fast iteration cycle as a business, if we have a high level operational excellence, which I think we do, then we can actually account for unexpected increases through an iterative cycle that examines the forecast against actuals on a weekly or monthly basis. And that will allow us to see that, you know, either we're growing faster than we thought we would, or we're not growing as fast as we thought we would. And that gives us some sense of, you know, where are we in terms of our current performance against expected performance. And that tells us a little bit about how much confidence, tells us about where we are in that confidence curve. And if we're exceeding where we thought we were going to be, that's a sign that maybe we might need to have some additional capacity, even in addition to what we had actually expected we would need. So we can actually modify our forecasts in flight based upon where we are today versus where we thought we were going to be. So let's say we think we're going to need 20% more capacity, and our confidence boundary says, well, it might be as high as like 26 or 27%. Then we get to the future state and we end up being at, you know, we're already at like 22% or something like that. So we're 2% above where we expected. That's a good sign that we're probably going to need more than we thought we would in the future. So we can in that case recommend a higher level of confidence, because, you know, we appears to be like the system is changing more than the historic values could account for.
So let's transition this conversation to talk about things that, you know, you're currently working on that are being used, and things in development, and how does that factor into this product of analytics as a service?
No, that's a totally good question. So I'll give you a high level view of what we try to accomplish here in terms of data science in the cloud. We're really interested in having a high level situational awareness of what the cloud is doing at any given time. And what this means is we want to have the ability to understand if it's behaving normally or abnormally. And we want to understand immediately if something bad's happening. And we want to try to prevent bad things from happening by planning appropriately. And so there's really, in my mind, 4 categories of issues we try to go after. The first one I'll mention is one we've already talked about for quite a bit, which is the idea of the utilization of the platform. What do we think the future utilization of it's going to be? And can we accommodate that growth with our current procurement plans? And so we tried to prevent utilization-related incidents primarily by planning future capacity to meet our expected demand. But there's other kinds of incidents that are a little bit harder to plan for. For example, let's say there's a software configuration issue that causes some of the network devices to become unreachable. If that happens, and we want to be able to detect that immediately, obviously, but it can be kind of hard to predict that because it's something that gets pushed out to our platform, and then kind of immediately there's a change in state. And so that's, we really want to go after stuff like that more from a detection perspective. Same with the next one I'll mention is hardware failures. You know, occasionally a device will fail, or the port on a device will fail, or maybe there's an optical cable that's going out. There's opportunities there to both predict and to detect those kinds of events. And the final one might be this idea of attacks. And, you know, a cloud is a shared resource. And unfortunately, there's people that kind of either abuse the terms of service, or people that are actively trying to compromise machines or perform with some sort of a denial of service attack. And these are the kinds of things that we as cloud provider will deal with and try to obviously try to prevent them from taking place through having high level security and through having a kind of internal best practices that are in line with the industry standard. But there's also times when we can't account for the fact that the whole bunch of machines start sort of pinging a VM in our network and stuff like that. So what we can do then is we want to be able to detect that attack's taking place pretty quickly. And so all this idea comes back to, as we try to understand our cloud, we want to have the ability to detect changes in state, to detect sort of anomalous activity patterns, and to quickly bring those anomalous activity patterns to the attention of our platform engineers and to the attention of our customer service engineers that are really talented at sort of root causing things and putting a stop to stuff in short order. So in the way that we approach this is through creating anomaly detection frameworks and through creating incident detection frameworks that we use to predict or detect that bad things are happening. And this is all stuff that we're working on right now. In some cases, we have these things currently in production. And in some cases, there's improvements we're making to these algorithms that are just kind of in the planning stages or in the pipeline. And so one of the things that we're working on at CenturyLink Cloud is more or less a real-time awareness of unexpected events and being able to tie those unexpected events to the actions that we think our platform engineers should take to mitigate the events. And we try to plan as best we can for things like capacity, and we try to detect things like hardware failure. We try to detect things like attacks as quickly as possible. And so as it relates to analytics as a service, you know, we have already internally examples of real-time prediction algorithms that we're using to go after these incidents. And as a first sort of vertical that we want to go after with analytics as a service, we could consider using some of these techniques inside a big data platform that potentially customers could apply to their own data to allow them to understand the performance of their application, for example. And so the where all this stuff connects to analytics as a service is that we can use these same techniques in an analytics as a service platform to help people manage and monitor their own applications. We have actually been working on an analytics platform that will allow customers to send messages to us, and then we can use this platform, which, by the way, this platform is still taking shape. It's not like it's in production yet. It's still just kind of actively being developed. But the idea is to allow customers to have a platform they can use to send us messages, and then we can use some of the same techniques we've already been using internally to help customers manage the metrics that they send to us. And so such a platform would be useful for people that are running applications or who have their own infrastructure that they want to monitor or who want to supplement some of the monitoring that they're already doing using this approach. But it'd also be useful as a platform that we can extend to really help people make sense of time series data that comes from a broad variety of different kinds of connected devices. And so, I mean, the short term, I think, is that it directly relates to kind of some of the stuff we're doing internally here, but in the long term, I think there's opportunity for it to be a platform that people can leverage for a broad variety of purposes.
It seems like so much of what you're going to be involved in, or you are involved in, it revolves around database paradoxes, trends that take place on, I would say, the sum of the parts versus maybe independent parts. And we've talked about this before, but can you talk about how you handle some of these trend-based paradoxes in your scope of what you do from day to day?
No, that's a great question. There's a lot of paradoxes in data, and it's hard to really account for all of them, but you do your best, and through doing research and through, you know, kind of the experience of learning the hardware, you kind of get a sense of what you need to account for. And I'll give you a couple examples of the ones we deal with here. You mentioned the sum of the parts. That's a really good example of a paradox that takes place in businesses, and I've seen it in more than one business. The idea there is that, you know, the trend that the business looks at the highest level could be different than the trend that takes place on at the smaller level. So in our case, the usage of, if I were to look at the total utilization of like a data center, it might be different than like the utilization of all the devices. It could be the case that, you know, the total data center looks healthy, but, you know, in the future, like, so let's say it looks like in the future we won't need that much more capacity for a data center. But when you look at like the host level, for example, it might be the case that a lot of the hosts are going way up and won't be able to accommodate the additional growth in the future. And so how can that be? Well, the reality is that some of the hosts are being used more than others. And so when we do this kind of analysis and we predict in the future, it's important to start your analysis at the unit of analysis that is the one that the business controls. So in our case, we have devices. The trend at the device or the host level could be different than the trend at the data center level. And this is really an example of Simpson's paradox, and it takes place in virtually every kind of KPI situation that businesses have, where they aggregate KPIs across different factors. And the trend, the paradox basically states that the aggregate trend could be different than the trend at the level of the individual parts. I think the famous example is the idea that the college admission level could be, for example, for women might be higher than for men. And you wonder why, how could that be the case? It must be that certain programs are admitting women more than men. So you look at all the different programs, and you look at like biology, and you look at like physics, and you look at English, and you discover that all of these programs actually admit people at exactly the same rate. Then you wonder, well, how can it be the case that the admission rate overall is higher for one gender than it is for the other if all the individual programs have the same admission rate? And the answer is, well, you know, certain people might be self-selecting into programs that have a lower acceptance rate. So let's say, for example, like physics has a lower overall acceptance rate. Well, if more men were, you know, trying to become in the physics program and it had a lower acceptance rate, and more women were going into what's another science that's similar, like biology or something like that, and it had a higher acceptance rate, well, then at the high level, you'd say, oh, there's a different acceptance rate by gender. But the reality is it's just a self-selection problem. And so we have the same thing within businesses, especially in cloud, where there's a self-selection into different hosts, a self-selection into different data centers based upon people's individual preferences. And so to accurately forecast, we have to sort of start at the low level and build our forecast upwards. Because if we were to just start at the high level and just sort of analyze the highest level, we would potentially miss some of these hosts that would run out of memory. And, you know, this is only one of the paradoxes, Jonathan. There's a couple other ones that I can mention here too, which is, I think the second one that comes to mind is the idea of the sample rate that you use to measure things. So if you were to ask me, hey, what was the temperature yesterday? I could tell you, well, it's Seattle, so it's kind of cloudy, and it was like 68 degrees. Okay. Then you say, well, what time did you take that measurement? Was it 3 o'clock? Was it noon? Was it, you know, in the middle of the night? And so the time at which I took the measurement matters, right? Because intuitively know that there's sort of a daily cycle where it gets warm in the afternoon, it's cold in the morning. And so, well, okay, maybe I take one measurement in the morning and one in the afternoon, and we average the two together, and then I call that the temperature. Well, what if I take 5 measurements or 10 measurements? Or what if I take a measurement every 20 seconds. The rate at which I measure will actually influence what I believe the overall average is. And that's because the more frequently you measure, the more of the variability you can capture in your sampling rate. And this is kind of the Nyquist-Shannon paradox, where, you know, the determining the ideal sample rate is actually an algorithm in and of itself. You know, if I were to only measure once a day, I've basically smoothed out all the activity into one data point. And so with devices, it's really important for us that we measure these devices at the right rate so we can get an accurate representation of their usage. And then on the flip side, we can't measure them all the time because we just don't have the resources to do that. The platformer would use all of its resources just measuring itself. So we need to have sort of a finite amount of times that we measure things, but we also have to ensure that we measure things in a way that gives us the right amount of data to have actionable forecasts. And so we pursue that internally with using a consistent polling rate across all devices, and then setting that polling rate to one which is both manageable and is also actionable from an algorithm perspective. So it's small enough that we actually capture the variation that matters. And there are other ways you can do that too, through using, for example, dynamic polling rates, which is something that we have thought about doing. And I think others actually do that in practice. But there's a lot of different things like this that come up in data science and in business that relate to the way you measure data, that relates to the way you analyze data, and it relates to the decisions you make. If I were to mention a third one, I might talk a little bit about the spotlight paradox. And the spotlight paradox is this idea that, you know, we only make decisions related to the information that we gather. So if I'm measuring the usage of these, like, three of the four hosts in a data center, I'll make capacity planning decisions for those three hosts. But if I haven't considered the fourth one, you know, I won't include that in my projection. And that's a simple example. So obviously we want to make sure that we have a way to automatically discover all of the new hardware that's been installed. But it's also, you know, relates to the kinds of metrics that we use for making capacity planning decisions. You know, do we just use CPU utilization, or do we also consider, for example, the temperature of the CPU? Do we consider the number of, do we just consider the total hard disk utilization, or do we also consider the hard disk in and output writes? So the kinds of things that we consider, you know, we'll make decisions as a function of the things we consider in our models. And this kind of relates to, you know, back to baseball, where, you know, if you want to manage which players you have on your team, or how to help coach those players to be more successful, you can really only give them that coaching related to the metrics you have about their performance. So, for example, if you're only measuring runs batted in, then you can really only give coaching to that metric. You can't, for example, give them coaching on hits, because you won't necessarily have that data. So it's sort of important to think about, you know, when we're making decisions, that we to make sure that we have all of the information necessary to make the actionable decision, we also don't want to overwhelm the decision maker. We don't want to include so much information that there's a kind of a information overload, you know, where it's not clear what the next step should be. And so it's kind of a balance, typically that's handled through applying some business domain expertise, or through looking at what other people, you typically handle that through secondary research, which means looking at research papers, looking at what other people are doing. You can also do some primary research by just interviewing domain experts and looking at what business owners and stakeholders want. So all of these things are kind of related, and yet it's kind of a lot to keep track of, especially as you try to solve problems that aren't really that tractable. You want to keep track of the different paradoxes and conundrums that can take place, and to have that consistent data-driven perspective throughout, then from beginning to end, in terms of the process workflow for a business. Getting involved in For example, the decision of how often we sample devices, getting involved in, for example, the conversation about what metrics we include, getting involved in, for example, the way that we create predictions and how we aggregate those predictions, inserting yourself as a data-oriented thinker into the right conversations will allow the business to have success in making long-term decisions, long-term plans.
It seems to me that one of the most commonly used, and we'll kind of wrap up the paradox talk here, was one you mentioned before to me, which was had to do with anonymity and basically telling somebody or understanding that it doesn't take all that information, that much information, to get a good view of the user or the users of a certain application or of a platform. You probably see that quite often in your day to day, right?
Yeah, I think I probably dealt with that more in the online advertising world than I do here. For the most part, we just at CenturyLink Cloud, we just look at the overall usage of devices. But for example, if I were an online advertiser and I saw that you visited my site, I could keep track of things like the kind of device you had. I could keep track of things like the browser that you're using. I could keep track of things like, they're not supposed to do this, but I'm pretty sure they do, or they keep track of the kinds of cookies you have. And, after two or three of those things, they pretty much have a unique fingerprint for you. And, you come back to the site and maybe you clicked on an ad that was related to like a new smartwatch that you wanted to buy. Well, you come back to that site and now they know that to show ads about smartwatches because last time you were there, you're interested in that. And they can uniquely identify you as the same individual based upon a relatively small number of factors. And I think that, for the idea would be this, like if you think there's a lot of publicly available information that people, I think, don't realize, it takes only a few pieces of information to really uniquely identify someone. So like, for example, if you had like someone's like zip code and date of birth and maybe their gender, that's probably a unique identifier. I mean, may not be exactly unique in an urban area, but like in suburban and rural areas, for sure it would be, right? Like, so if you wanted to, if you had that information and you had a model that like, created prices for auto insurance by date of birth and zip code, for example, well, that model is basically has the discriminating power of at the individual level. And so even though you have excluded all individual information, that model still has the ability to discriminate on individual level features. And so that's one of the things you want to keep track of too, is how do we make sure that our models are providing information to the business that relates to business factors and still sort of safeguarding the idea that there's kind of this keeping the sort of necessary level of anonymity abstracted so that we don't inadvertently create discriminations at the individual level. Now, there are businesses that want to do that and sell that as a product. There's data brokers out there whose sole business proposition is we have the ability to uniquely identify an individual who visits your site as belonging to a certain set of cohorts. And a cohort is a fancy way of saying behavioral attributes. Psychometric attributes such as, hey, this person is interested in shoes, they're interested in travel, and they're interested in learning French as a foreign language or something like that. And so they can keep track of those at the individual level and they can sell that information to online advertisers. And that's not something we do here, but it is when you talk about the paradox of anonymity. It's worth mentioning that, even if someone doesn't have your individual information, if you give a couple of what would seem high level or sort of factors, they can still create a model that has the ability to determine who more or less what you're interested in based upon what you're interested in the past.
So much of what we are discovering when we talk about the cloud and the platform and how to leverage these data sets and how to utilize what you do, we get into this idea of thought leadership in a world governed by technology and data, and get into the predictive practices and go even extending into the industrial IoT. Can you talk briefly about the cloud is a form of the Internet of Things.
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's the Internet of Things is a very popular word right now, and it's kind of a catchphrase, but it has a lot of impact. And I think there's really two kinds of Internet of Things. There's the industrial Internet of Things, and there's the consumer Internet of Things. You know, the consumer Internet of Things is one I think gets a lot of buzz. It's things like smart cars, smart homes, wearable technologies, fitness sensors, things like that. But the industrial IoT is already here and is capable of producing an unfathomable amount of data. For example, wind turbines all have sensors on them, hydraulic turbines, oil pumps, CAT scans, medical technology, residential gateways, you know, DSL modems, our edge routers, everything has the ability to sort of get this digital dust. And the industrial IoT is already here. For example, we already have the ability to capture the network activity on the sub-interfaces of all of our network devices. Each router may have like 3,000 metrics. We have something like a half a billion metrics every day that we get from our cloud devices. And that's at the sample rate even. That's not continuous data. So if we think about the IoT, I think it's already here. And it will certainly become consumer grade in the near future. But as we, as CenturyLink, as a telecommunications company that has a large amount of these devices already in our pipeline, already in our fabric, we have the ability to sort of help the industry think about how we can leverage this information to make a platform that's more efficient, how we can leverage this information to figure out the amount of information we'll need, the amount of capacity we'll need in the future. We can leverage this information to help create new products that maybe customers didn't have the ability to have before. And I think what we'll see is that increasingly companies will rely upon the industrial IoT data to reduce the cost of operating and of maintaining their expensive assets. And the asset could be like what we have, which is a network that's just spans the whole country. Or it could be like what GE's got, hundreds of turbines that are all extremely expensive. And you know, hospitals all have a medical equipment that needs to be operating at a high level. And their medical equipment's extremely expensive too. I mean, a lot of the costs that people theorize, a lot of the healthcare costs relate to the cost of some of these devices. So I think in terms of creating opportunities for optimization in industry, especially in the short term, I think that the Internet of Things from an industrial perspective is really compelling.
So what would you say is on the horizon for you personally? I know you mentioned that you've got some conferences that you might be attending, and you and I have gone back and forth about what we want to create in terms of content, but can you speak to some of these upcoming conferences as we wind down here and give people and listeners an insight into what you'll be exploring and feedback you're looking to get and maybe what you're looking to learn yourself?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that I really enjoy going to conferences. I think they're a way to figure out what people are working on, and other than, you know, kind of getting outside your shell and getting a larger perspective and seeing what's coming up in industry in the next 3 to 5 years, you know. And the reason that's what's coming up in industry in 3 to 5 years is because that's what people are working on right now. And you can see that when you go to a conference. You know, if I share some of what I'm working on, they'll learn from me and vice versa. And my research interests really are in two areas that relate to decision making, which are concept inference and causal inference. And the idea of a concept is this notion that, you know, when the cloud's unhealthy, there's something happening in the cloud. That something that's happening is a concept that we're trying to discover. And then we want to be able to do causal inference, which is understanding what caused that concept to take place. And so I tried to pursue this from the perspective of unstructured, unsupervised learning, which is a it's a techno term for saying an algorithm that doesn't have to be told how to discover things. It sort of figures it out on its own. And there's a lot of other people in the field that are kind of working on things like that. And so when I go to conferences, it's a chance for me to learn from what others are doing in the similar area and for them to see what I'm up to. So kind of real quickly here, there's one in Seattle here on machine learning coming up in May. And then there's one in late May. I'll be going to PyCon, which is in Portland. And then I got one in June. I'll be going to another conference. And then in mid-July is really where it heats up, because I'm going to HCI International, which is in Toronto. And that's a conference on a human-computer interaction. And they focus on creating decision-making technologies that use data. And so I hope to really learn from what other people in my field are doing there. And hopefully they can learn a little bit about what I'm up to. And then in late July, I'm going to a conference in St. Louis on big data, where I'll be talking about prediction and IoT. And so, you know, what am I looking to learn about? I'm looking to learn, what is the perspective or consensus of other scientists and industry in terms of how we can leverage data to really succeed in the age of industrial IoT? And how can we create intelligent systems that can make inferences in the context of these IoT deployments? And so it's really kind of an emerging area. And yeah, I'm definitely willing to help contribute to the conversation. And I hope that when I get back from these conferences, I'll be able to sort of synthesize all of what I've learned and sort of create some, create some new posts or create some new ideas about how we could be successful in the next couple of years and how we can really sort of continue to lead the way.
So is people want to get a hold of you and communicate with you based on what we've talked about on this podcast or any other collaborative ideas. Are you on social media or in LinkedIn and they can maybe find you there? Can you provide that information?
Yeah, totally. If you're in this space and you're really interested in data, or you're interested in sort of the cloud stuff or IoT, you know, go ahead and reach out to me. I'm in on Twitter. You can find me. It's Ryan_Kirk. And on LinkedIn, you can find me too. It's Ryan Allen Kirk on LinkedIn, and you should come up.
Perfect. Well, Ryan, it's been awesome learning from you and talking to you about these ideas, and you've certainly educated me, and I'm sure the listeners will feel the same. And we're really looking forward to continued podcasts with you and more articles and more thought leadership on your end. So really, thank you for taking the time to talk with me, and I hope you have a good one.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. I enjoyed the conversation. I look forward to continuing to collaborate with you.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the CenturyLink Cloud Podcast, where each and every episode is geared to showcase what we're working to be industry leaders by sharing ideas, accomplishments, and highlighting the great things we do at CenturyLink Cloud. Until next time, take care.